Welcome to the Earth First Update. I'm Uncle Dennis in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz on Thursday, March 9th. I'd like to ask you to have a pencil and paper handy because you might want to write down names, addresses, telephone numbers, web pages, any information you need to start taking action. Let's start off with announcements. The Alameda Creek Alliance is holding an Alameda Creek Restoration Day on Saturday, March 11th. Join us for a morning of habitat restoration along Alameda Creek. We will be working to enhance riparian habitat along Alameda Creek this Saturday, March 11th from 10 a.m. to noon at the Niles Staging Area in Fremont, California. We'll continue clearing invasive plants this month and do some general cleaning around our restoration site. We're making great progress clearing invasive Cape ivy from the riparian trees at our adopted spot in Niles, and we'll continue with those efforts. We'll also weed around our recent plantings and give them some water. Meet at 10 a.m. at the Niles Staging Area parking lot along Old Canyon Road near Canyon Oaks Court in Niles area of Fremont, California, roughly the 720 Old Canyon Road area. We'll work until noon. Visit our Eventbrite page for directions and more information. Please go to their website, alamedacreek.org. Please wear long pants and sturdy and closed-toed shoes so that you can get dirty. No sandals or flip-flops, please. We provide gloves and tools. The work isn't on much of a slope, but the ground can be uneven. The ground will likely be wet, so please wear clothes that can get dirty. There is no poison oak in the immediate area where we'll be working. Expect cool weather and morning dew when we start. Heavy rain will cancel, but there's none in the forecast. All participants need signed waiver forms, one for the Alameda Creek Alliance and one for Alameda County, and anyone under 18 years of age needs a parental signature. Once again, that's this Saturday, March 11th, at the Niles Canyon, roughly 720 Old Canyon Road in Niles, California. And that webpage again, www.alamedacreek.org. And announcing the 2017 Earth First Roadshow, greetings all rabble-rousers, water protectors, land defenders, anti-fascists, and resistance fighters. In the light of all the insanity that is our present political climate, a group of Earth Firsters are excited to announce the 2017 Earth First Roadshow. We'll be hitting the road and planning a two-month-long cross-country roadshow that will end at the Round River Rendezvous in Northern California. We want to nurture the inspiring seeds of dissidents, learn about and support various cross-country struggles, and connect people and places to a political platform of Donald Trump and all the white supremacy, eco-terror, and rage he instills. Beginning in late April, we'll be kicking off our tour in South Florida, and we aim to plan a route that coincides with several action camps and conferences throughout the country. Dates and places will be announced. Will you have them? Well, you need to send them an email. We'll give you that in a minute. Small and rural towns will be given priority as we hash out dates and times. Get in touch with our collective to receive a list of skill shares and workshops we can offer in addition to a short presentation promoting biocentrism within a cross-struggle framework. For all that is wild and for a more free world, your friendly 2017 Earth First Roadshow crew. For booking, questions, and comments, email to Earth First Roadshow 2017 at riseup.net. That's Earth First Roadshow 2017 at riseup.net. And you can go to their webpage, earthfirstroadshow17.wordpress.com. That's earthfirstroadshow17.wordpress.com for tour updates and more information. And from Biteback Magazine, we get the following news. During the night of November 21st, 2016, I guess they're releasing this a little late, hundreds of mink were freed from cages at a fur farm in San Marco Ravenna in Italy. The mink know that the executioner is set to arrive with the gas, but they also know that with the noise of cages breaking, one jump leads out into the night and freedom. And for more information, go to directaction.info, where you can find out a whole lot more about what's going on. And here's the Buffalo Field Campaign roundup for this week. This winter, buffalo death toll has breached 1,000 and continues to climb. Counting the few hundred buffalo still trapped inside Yellowstone's Stevens Creek capture facility and the continued hunting pressures just outside the park, the government agencies will likely surpass their goal of killing 1,300 ecologically extinct wild migratory buffalo this year. And that doesn't even include the significant number of buffalo deaths due to natural causes from the severe winter. Hundreds of thousands of people are seeing and sharing the Buffalo Field campaign stories and images of Yellowstone's shameful crimes against wild buffalo on their webpage. These actions are being conducted with your tax dollars on behalf of Montana's livestock industry. This morning, Buffalo Field campaign will be attending the second media tour inside the trap. The atrocious actions we're witnessing and documenting continue despite thousands, if not tens of thousands, of calls, emails, and letters to Yellowstone Superintendent Dan Wenk and Montana Governor Steve Bullock. Most people who reach these decision makers are meeting with frustration, being told lies in condescending tones by the governor's office that Yellowstone is responsible for the slaughter, while Yellowstone officials say that's all Montana's fault and there's nothing they can do to stop it. As the number of slaughtered buffalo climbs due to their actions, these same decision makers toss up their hands in mock helplessness. However, they are both responsible and they can both take immediate and necessary actions today to end this senseless war against the wild buffalo. These decision makers work collaboratively within the Interagency Bison Management Plan to devise and carry out agreed-upon management schemes, and their deceptive pass-the-buck strategy of shirking responsibility is pushing the country's last continuously wild buffalo herds towards the brink of extinction. Please continue to make calls. If you're outside of the United States, send letters and emails. Be relentless. Don't accept their excuses. The phone calls are most effective because they cannot be ignored. Yellowstone Superintendent Dan Wenk, his number, area code 307-344-2002. That's area code 307-344-2002. Montana Governor Steve Bullock's number is area code 406-444-3111. That's area code 406-444-3111. And from the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, we hear about the end of Operation Nemesis, as written by Captain Alex Cornelison. The arrival of the Ocean Warrior in Henderson, West Australia, marks the end of this year's anti-whaling campaign against Japanese whale poachers in the Southern Ocean. Our ships have been at sea for 93 days. And the Ocean Warrior has been at sea for 93 days, and the Steve Irwin was at sea for 90 days. During this entire time, they searched for the floating slaughterhouse, the Nishin Maru, but we regret to say we were unable to lock into the stern of the Japanese factory ship. We don't know how successful we have been until the whaling fleet returns to port and announces the number of whales they've killed, but we do know we have kept them on the move during our time in the pristine waters of Antarctica and cost the company millions of dollars in doing so. Considering the length of time the whaling fleet has remained in the Southern Ocean, it's clear our presence severely limited the effectiveness of their poaching operations. Their greatly reduced quota of only 333 whales, thanks to Sea Shepherd's previous years of campaigning, could easily be reached within mere weeks of uninterrupted whaling. But this time the whalers needed more than 3 months, and it's still doubtful they reached their target. We knew this would be a very difficult campaign for several reasons. The whaling fleet's new whaling program doubled the size of the hunting area from previous years under the JARPA 2 program, deemed not for scientific purposes by the International Whaling Commission in 2014, making it more difficult for us to track them down. The reduced quota of 333 whales makes it harder for us to be as successful as before if we measure our success in the number of whale lives we save. When their self-allocated quota was 1,035 whales, we were usually able to prevent them from killing more than a third of that each season, but not less, despite our efforts. The extended duration of the killing season allows the whalers to stay down in the Southern Ocean as long as the weather allows. It also makes it more difficult for Sea Shepherd to intervene the entire whaling season as our fuel capacity is limited. The whaling fleet's fuel supply vessel allows them to stay in the Southern Ocean and run at high speed for the entire season. One of the other changes in the so-called research program is the transferable quota. Any whales we manage to save this year can simply be added to the quota in following years. In Sea Shepherd's case, we need to cover far greater distances than before, thus burning far more fuel than before. Whenever we got near the harpoon vessels or found discarded whale blubber in the sea, indicating we were close to where recent kills occurred and therefore near the fleet, the factory ship simply took off at full speed in the opposite direction, as seen in our helicopter footage. The Steve Irwin was shadowed by the Yushin Maru 3, thus making one of the harpoon vessels out of action for 36 days. The Ocean Warrior was detected on several occasions by other harpoon vessels, a clear sign that these ships were actively trying to track our new interceptor vessel to relay our position to the Nishin Maru. Obviously, that takes them out of their whaling actions as well, and the superior speed of the Ocean Warrior made it easy to drop the tailing vessel, no doubt making the whaling fleet very nervous. Additional factors: the weather was really bad this year, limiting the number of days that whaling was possible. The whalers indicated that they do not want any confrontations with Sea Shepherd. This obviously is a very different strategy from previous campaigns when our ships were rammed, nearly disabled, and we even lost one ship because of Japanese whaler assaults. The reason for this change in strategy is obvious. The Japanese whalers want to show our intervention is useless, that they will reach their quota despite our presence. They hope it will lower our morale until we simply give up. The question is, did they succeed in breaking our resistance? Even not knowing if they have reached their quota, I can still confirm that they did not. Even not being able to get one of our ships behind the slipway of the factory ship, our ultimate goal, we still caused major disruptions to their whaling program. Any whale that was saved from the 333 condemned to death was worth us going to the Southern Ocean again this season. And even if the quota is met in full, once again, Sea Shepherd was the only organization standing in the way of this government-sponsored poaching program. We captured images of a dead whale lying on the slaughterhouse ship's deck while the international community did nothing, and while the Australian government in particular welcomed the Japanese Prime Minister's official state visit with open arms. Why? Because of trade as well as political agreements with Japan. Financial gain over the preservation of social and intelligent species, stubborn pride over ecological sanity, one nation against the world's opinion. This year has taught us that we need to do more if we're going to stop the whale poachers next season. We are a grassroots NGO fighting a war against the Japanese government-funded whaling fleet. We rely on donations and volunteers while they spend millions of government money to sustain this slaughter for the non-existent demand of whale meat in an industry which hasn't generated income in over a decade. We need your support more than ever if we are to succeed. If we had the money, we'd be able to send 10 ships down there supported by our own fuel supply vessel. I feel nothing but pride for the captains and crew of the Ocean Warrior and the Steve Irwin. They were the only ones down there trying to stop the Japanese whale poachers. Having myself been down on those waters on 5 occasions, I know of the sacrifice they have made enduring storms and hardship, battling seasickness, and being away from their beloved ones for when the whole world celebrates the holidays. For that, I have great respect for each and every member of our crew. And you can get more information at www.seashepherd.org.au. And turning to the Center for Biological Diversity, good news in dark times. A third jaguar has been detected in Arizona. Big news from the southwest. Another new jaguar has been detected on a trail camera in southeast Arizona, a third in the past year and a half. The animal was roaming in the Dos Cabezas Mountains, about 60 miles north of the U.S.-Mexico border. Jaguars are trying hard to return to their homeland in the United States, said Randy Seraglio with the Center for Biological Diversity, but Trump's $20 billion border wall boondoggle could stop them. It's devastating for human communities and wildlife as well. A young male jaguar was photographed on the Fort Huachuca Military Reservation last November, and a large male jaguar in the Santa Rita Mountains became an internet sensation last year after being named El Jefe by Tucson schoolchildren. The new jaguar's sex is unknown. The center has been working for decades to save jaguars. In 2014, we secured more than 750,000 acres of federal land in protected critical habitat for U.S. jaguar recovery. And on his first day in office, Zinke rolls back protections from lead ammo. After riding into his downtown Washington, D.C. office on a horse named Tonto for his first day at work, new Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke quickly revoked Obama's phase-out of lead ammunition and fishing tackle on national wildlife refuges. Looking to cash in on the $30 million it spent on ads promoting Trump's election, the National Rifle Association had pressured Zinke to reverse Obama's science-based decision. Switching to non-toxic ammunition should be a no-brainer to save the lives of both wildlife and people, said the Senator's Jonathan Evans. It's ironic that one of the first actions by Secretary Zinke, who fancies himself a champion of hunters and anglers, leads to poisoning of game and waterfowl, not to mention the hunters' families, and thousands urge Texas to end wildlife gassing. Center for Biological Diversity has submitted a petition with more than 5,400 signatures asking Texas wildlife officials to ban the harmful practice of using gasoline and other toxic substances to hunt rattlesnakes. Commonly called gassing, this indiscriminate hunting method harms habitats and non-target wildlife, including endangered species living in holes and crevices, along with rattlesnakes. Texas is one of the last states in the union where gassing is still legal. And a ruling is allowing for widespread killing of Wyoming wolves. Somber news for gray wolves in Wyoming. The U.S. Court of Appeals has reversed a 2014 court decision that had restored Endangered Species Act protection to these beautiful persecuted predators. The Center for Biological Diversity and Allies challenged the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's 2012 decision to strip the wolves of protections and hand over wolf management to the state of Wyoming, which promotes unlimited wolf killing across the state. Wolves in the rest of the Northern Rockies have already lost federal protection. Mass Wyoming wolf killings could wipe out any chance of their recovery. We've been working long and hard to defend Wyoming wolves, said the Senator's Noah Greenwald, and we won't let this ruling stop us now. And Tanzania has jailed a notorious elephant poacher. Tanzania's most notorious elephant poacher, nicknamed the Devil, has been sentenced to 12 years in prison. Boniface Matthew Miliango was responsible for killing thousands of elephants, a conservation organization says. He was arrested in Dar es Salaam in September of 2015 after a year-long manhunt. His crimes were the focus of a Netflix documentary film, The Ivory Game, produced by actor Leonardo DiCaprio. Miliango's nickname, Shetani, means devil in Swahili. The African Elephant Action League, which fights wildlife crime, said he ran an ivory trafficking network across five African countries, including Tanzania, Burundi, Zambia, Mozambique, and southern Kenya. He was sentenced alongside his brothers, Lucas Mathayo Miliango and Abdallah Ali Shawaga. The three were arrested in October 2015 while attempting to smuggle tusks worth more than $850,000. Miliango has been accused of supplying ivory to Chinese citizen Yang Fenglan, known as the Ivory Queen, who is on trial in Tanzania for trafficking more than 700 elephant tusks worth more than $2.5 million. Conservationists say the demand for ivory in China was fueling the poaching. Although there is an international ban on buying and selling ivory across its borders, it is allowed inside certain countries. In December of 2016, China announced a ban on all ivory trade and processing activities by the end of 2017. And poachers are trying to hack animal tracking systems. Animal tracking through electronic tagging has helped researchers gain insight into the lives of many wild animal species, but it can also be misused by wildlife poachers, hunters, animal persecution groups, and people interested in seeing and interacting with the animals, all to the detriment of our animal brethren. A recent paper by a group of researchers from several Canadian and U.S. universities has pointed to several instances of misuse and attempted misuse of tracking technology. In 2013, poachers attempted to hack into the email account of a wildlife conservation in India because the tracking collar fitted on a specific tiger sent us regular GPS information about the animal's position to the conservationist's email address. In Australia, tracking tags were fitted on white sharks so researchers could find out more about their behavior and make plans to facilitate their conservation. The information was also used to inform a system that warns beachgoers about dangers they may be encountered on any given day. Unfortunately, the same data was ultimately misused in a shark culling program. It is widely thought that hunters discovered the classified radio frequencies of the GPS collars fitted on some of the wolf population in Yellowstone National Park in Wyoming and used them to track and kill a number of wolves that were being tracked for research purposes. In Minnesota, some anglers petitioned for access to movement data derived from electronic tagging of northern pike to aid in fish capture. They were unsuccessful. The researchers believe that instances of poachers intercepting signals to track animals down are underreported, as the researchers and conservationists are worried about losing funding. Reports of abuses of GPS tagging occasionally appear in blogs and research websites, and sometimes in local news, but by and large the issue has not appeared in scientific literature, although the problem is becoming more difficult to ignore. Researchers have also noted that photographers and people interested in seeing wild animals have been known to acquire and use tracking equipment, and they are worried that frequent exposure of animals to people can habituate them to human interaction, which at a minimum alters the animal's natural behavior, thus negatively influencing research findings. They are also worried that non-researchers can easily purchase and deploy their own tags, which could interfere with research efforts in a number of ways. The tagging devices are usually collars with GPS or radio transmitters and cost between 150 to 4,000 pounds, the Times reports. But unfortunately, security measures for protecting their signal are not adequate. In the case of Yellowstone wolves, hunters discovered the frequencies at which the radio transmitters operated by using cheap receivers. In the case of the Indian tiger, where a satellite-based tagging system was used, the information was sent directly to the researchers' email accounts, and we all know how easily those can be compromised. The researchers are calling for other researchers to delve into the issue, but also want electronic tagging manufacturers, research managers, and stakeholders to meet and discuss their responsibilities, share information, create policies and solutions that would keep data secure, and more. And finally, they want regulators to develop clear and enforceable policies and regulations that limit the ability of the public to use telemetry tools for activities which are inconsistent with the mission of animal management agencies. And help protect the Ventana wilderness from permanent fire breaks. The U.S. Forest Service is asking for public comments now on its draft environmental impact statement for the Strategic Community Fuel Break Improvement Project in the Ventana Wilderness in California. Your help is needed by March 13th to end permanent artificial fire lines within the wilderness and allow the Ventana Wilderness to restore its wilderness character. The 237,000-acre Ventana Wilderness straddles the Santa Lucia Mountains south of the Monterey Peninsula in the Big Sur country of Southern California. All but 720 acres lie in the Los Padres National Forest and are managed by the Forest Service. Originally designated as a wilderness in 1969, Congress has added more land to the Ventana Wilderness four additional times in 1978, 84, 92, and 2002. Fire has had a frequent presence in the Ventana Wilderness, as it has in many wildernesses. Congress included special language in several of the additions bills, allowing the Forest Service to conduct some pre-suppression activities in those wilderness additions to keep the fires from burning outside the wilderness. In the new draft environmental impact statement, the Forest Service proposes to reestablish and permanently maintain 10.4 miles of fuel breaks or fire lines within the wilderness. To its credit, the agency proposes not to use bulldozers to reconstruct the fire breaks, but it would allow chainsaws and other motorized tools to build the fire breaks. But there are no guarantees bulldozers won't be called in again when the next fire occurs. Fire breaks are often ineffective in stopping fires. The 2016 Sobranes fire in this wilderness, for example, spotted or jumped ahead a mile and a half in front of the flames, a much greater distance than the width of the fire lines. Research shows the best way to protect structures is to control vegetation and other flammable products near the structure. Wilderness Watch believes the Forest Service, first and foremost, should act to protect the wilderness character of the Ventana Wilderness, particularly when the research shows that fuel breaks are often ineffective and that fireproofing homes is really the only effective means when accompanied by reducing flammable materials in the immediate vicinity of those structures. Contact the Forest Service by March 13th. Tell the agency to support Alternative 1, the no-action alternative, and urge the agency to focus fire prevention measures on the structure protection zone, usually 100 feet on either side of a structure, where it is most effective. And thank you for protecting the Ventana Wilderness. And you can find out more information at ventana.org. The recovery of grizzly bears in the North Cascades is pretty dismal. Fewer than 10 bears are likely to live in the whole region, so it's good news that the National Park Service and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service are considering increasing the North Cascades grizzly population in Washington by moving in bears from other populations. In the draft plan, the federal agencies proposed bringing bears in from Montana or British Columbia to increase the Cascades population by 200. We're happy to see the agencies taking a step in the right direction to restore grizzly bears to the North Cascades, says Andrea Santarciere, senior attorney with the Center for Biological Diversity. Without a helping hand, grizzly bears are likely to disappear from the Pacific Northwest. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening at 9 p.m. on Free Radio Santa Cruz, www.freakradio.org, and 101.3 FM. You can hear a rebroadcast tomorrow afternoon at 3 p.m. as part of our Environment Friday programming. You could also listen to WNMB 107.1 at North Adams, Massachusetts, Friday at 5:30 in the morning, KRFP 90.3 FM in Moscow, Idaho, Wednesdays at 3 p.m., WLSL 92.7 in Dade City, Florida, Sundays at noon, KGIG 104.9 in Modesto, California, broadcasts the Earth First Update, as does Berkeley Liberation Radio at 104.1. You can go online to gdprnashville.org. Once again, that's gdprnashville.org, Sundays at 2 a.m. for the Earth First Update. And you can always go to radioforall.net. That's radio, the number, forall.net, where you can listen online and download this or previous editions of the Earth First Update. And please ask your local nonprofit community radio station to air the Earth First Update every week. It is free to download and air. I'm Uncle Dennis. I want to thank you for listening to the Earth First Update. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced at Free Radio Santa Cruz. I want to thank you for listening, and do tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.